Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the Temptations sang "You Are My Everything" in 1967, we don't think they meant it literally. But today, millions of married Americans are looking to their spouse to be everything. Companion, best friend, lover, confidant. It may be too much to ask. Bad for marriage and for the rest of our social lives. This hour on Point, are we asking too much of marriage? Joining me to look at this from Tacoma, Washington, is Stephanie Kuntz. She's professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College, director of research and public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. She's the author of Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage, and a recent essay headlined, Too Close for Comfort. Stephanie Kuntz, great to have you back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So
my pleasure.
It's great to have you again, but we're a little confused here. First, we read a minority of American households now include a married couple, down to 47%, a clear minority for the first time. So on the one hand, it looks like there's less of it, but then you're saying, wait a minute, married people, those who are married, are depending maybe way too much on this single relationship. What's going on here?
Well, it's an interesting trade-off. For thousands of years, marriage was very stable because in the past people didn't expect so much of it, and it was very common because you had so few other options outside of marriage.
Right.
Before marriage or after marriage, even if you were miserable. Now that we have these much higher expectations of married love and friendship and confidential, mm-hmm. intimate communication, mm-hmm. I think that's good in a lot of ways. On the other hand, it interacts with two things. One is the world historic change in the role of marriage so that people are remaining unmarried longer and there are higher divorce rates. The average American spends half his or her life outside marriage. Mm. So, boy, if marriage is your only place for intimacy, you're a little bit in trouble. And even the marriages, well, a marriage that works fabulous compared to the past. But if it falters in any way, there's less to shore it up. And if it begins to go south, then there's fewer support systems to rely on outside of it. And this is, a lot of people think, today, people don't work on their relationships the way they used to. Actually, the fact is people didn't spend a lot of emotional energy and put all of their loyalties in that one basket of married love in the past. And in some ways, the fact that we do, despite its positive qualities, is a real problem.
We've got research, a new study, and more showing the numbers here. We're going to talk with one of the authors of this research. But give us the big picture, Stephanie. People are found to have fewer intimate friends, and more people saying that their spouse is the only person on the planet that they can really open up to, really see as a confidant and intimate.
Yes, and as a historian, I just have, well, and also as a wife who wouldn't like to live that way, I find this just sort of amazing. Throughout history, people would have thought that was pathological, selfish, dangerous, antisocial. You know, when you go back to the Christian past, some people really misinterpret this. Actually, one of the reasons that early Christians were suspicious of marriage is they said, look, a married man or a married woman thinks best how they can please their spouse. It's the unmarried who think more about pleasing God.
So there's a kind of vanity or self-regard in that one-on-one relationship.
Yes. In fact, in the 17th century, Protestant and Catholic ministers and priests alike warned against making an idolater of yourself by putting your wife or your husband first. The word love used to be defined right up until the early 19th century as a pleasing affection of the mind of someone that you could talk to. It was used as often for cousins or neighbors or for God or fellow church members as it was for your spouse.
You write about Victorian matrons thinking nothing of kicking their husbands out of bed when a female friend came to visit so they could spend the night pouring out their innermost thoughts with each other.
Oh, yes. You'll read these diaries, and it's amazing for someone my age who grew up with the diaries where, you know, every woman is asking, okay, how would my first name go with that man's last name? You know, their diaries are full of their passionate friendships for other women. And then suddenly one of them will say, accepted the marriage proposal of Mr. R last night. And you think, who the heck is Mr. R?
Sort of outside the magic circle.
And he doesn't appear again until, yes, they say, oh, my friend Fanny's coming to visit. And we kicked Mr. R into the parlor, and we spent all night pinching and hugging and talking. And, you know, nobody thought anything abnormal of this. And in fact, men also had very affectionate romantic friendships that were not sexual.
You mean with other women, with other men, both?
With other men, with other men. Mm-hmm. Men thought nothing of walking down the street arm in arm, of sharing a bedroll, of sharing a bed.
Old Abe Lincoln himself.
That's right.
Doing that in Springfield, Illinois, we read recently, before he went to Washington.
Yes, and then people say, well, maybe he was homosexual. But no, this was very, very common. I found letters of men to their fiancés, their female fiancés,
right,
saying, last night I sunk peacefully into friendship on the bosom of my friend Harry. And nobody thought anything of it. I mean, imagine a man saying that today.
And so there's a big network of people that they could turn to with problems, intimate thoughts, whatever it was on their mind. And now what we're hearing is, what you're writing about, is this trend where that's shrinking down to the circle of marriage itself. Stephanie Kuntz, if you could stand by for just a moment, I want to bring in one of the authors of this new research, joining us from Cascabel, Arizona. If I've got that right, Lynn Smith-Lovin is with us. Lynn, thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. Nice to be with you.
You're a professor of sociology at Duke University, co-author of this new study, Social Isolation in America. What have you found about this new dependence on the marriage partner above all?
Well, probably the biggest finding of our study was that the number of people who didn't have anyone to talk to about important matters had gone up dramatically from about 10% of the population to about 26% of the population.
Nobody, not even a spouse. So from that perspective, you're lucky to have a marriage partner as opposed to no one.
And being married really protected people against being totally isolated.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that ties into your topic most relevantly is that the spouse was the only kind of relationship that actually went up in its mention from 1985 to 2004. About 5% of people in 1985 relied just on their spouse, and that number almost doubled to almost 10% in 2004.
So you're describing a kind of lonely nation, but with the one relationship that's gaining some intensity, being marriage itself. You might say that's something to celebrate, but you say there's a problem here. Why?
Well, basically, if it's a problem for the people who aren't married because they don't have this intense kind of relationship, and we find that there's very little of any other kind of relationship that's stepping in and filling that void. And the other thing is that for the people who do rely just on a spouse, that means that if anything happens to that relationship or happens to that person, if they get ill, if the relationship breaks up, or if the person dies, then the person's been totally dependent on that one relationship, and they have no other social support system.
Now, even among those who don't rely just on their spouse, you find the shrinking number of people with whom Americans can discuss important personal issues. As I'm reading your numbers here, it looks like between 1985 and 2004, it dropped from a third, from 2.94, almost three, down to 2.808, essentially two. So on average, the country lost an intimate confidant over those nearly 20 years.
Yes. It's and we especially found that relationships with neighbors and people that you're in civic associations and voluntary groups with, and relationships with coworkers were all sharply down. So those are the kind of relationships outside the family that you have that kind of hold together the structure of a community in a neighborhood.
Hey, Lynn, what about you? You did this research with your husband. What's up with that? Don't you have anybody else you're close enough with to do the research?
Yes. It's Miller McPherson, who's the first author of this study, is my husband. He's my colleague in the Department of Sociology at Duke. And we're in lots of groups together, and we live in the same place. And so we're sort of indicative of this trend in the sense that we're sociologists call it, we're very structurally equivalent. We have a lot of the same interests and activities and very similar lives, and that makes us very, very close. But it is true that being that close to one other person does tend to leave less time for other kinds of activities.
So you look out there and you may see lots of very tight duos, but what about that broader interaction? Lynn, it's fascinating research, Professor Smith-Lovin, and we appreciate your bringing it to us. Thanks a lot for being with us today. Lynn Smith-Lovin, professor of sociology at Duke University, co-author of Social Isolation in America. Stephanie Kuntz, on the one hand, it's hard to knock the marriage if it's the only boat you've got to sit in, but with just two in there, you're saying this is hard on marriage itself.
Yes, I mean, I think we have to understand the trade-offs in this. Sometimes people will come to me and say, yes, and we should tamp down our expectations of marriage so that people don't walk away when it's not good. And, you know, I've studied the low-expectation marriages of the last 4,000 years, and I wouldn't recommend that, that people put up with stuff that it was just unbelievably bad. But I do think we have to raise up our expectations of other relationships outside marriage. We have this thing in America that inside marriage you owe everything, outside it you owe nothing. We don't recognize the real loyalties and commitments and social ties that must be built and should be respected outside marriage.
So keep it rich, keep it deep, but it's not necessarily. Stephanie Kuntz, stand by. We're going to hear in a moment from a marriage counselor. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking this hour whether we are asking too much of marriage these days, with the spouse increasingly our sole true friend and confidant. Stephanie Kuntz is with us, professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College, really a great observer of all this. She joins us from Tacoma, Washington. Questions for you. Why are Americans retreating to the tiny social circle of marriage? And do you see it, people pairing off in relative isolation? Is your marriage different from your parents? Did they have more gal pals and close buddies outside the union of two? Sally's calling from Moline, Illinois. Hi, Sally. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to add the comment. Families are so spread out now. I'm married with children, and there's no safety valve anymore of grandparents, extended family. So if the other spouse wants to have a life outside of marriage, you know, gal pals, like you say,
mm-hmm.
the other spouse is left at home with young children.
So you'd like to have that wider circle, but you've got nobody to lean on to take care of the kids to facilitate it.
Right, right. And it is hard to find good child care. So part of that is, I guess with it in my situation, there's a little bit of contention. Well, who gets to go out and play?
Right. Sure. And in the end, maybe nobody does, and you're left with each other, which is all right. But is it enough? Stephanie Kuntz, what's your explanation for why this is happening? Sally looks at family networks spread all over the country, and there's a kind of building block of a little more freedom or interdependency that's diminished.
Well, I think that's certainly a big part of it. You know, I think that we began to move away from it a little bit after the 1950s, when there was this incredible isolation of women being stuck in the house doing all the child care and all the family.
Be home and be happy.
Yes, exactly. Find all your fulfillment in marriage. And men saying, get out there and work and commute and don't have other friends. Come home and find all your fulfillment in this woman who's been waiting at home. And people on both men and women were discontented with that.
Who was pushing that message, Stephanie? Who was supporting that? I mean, that still stands there as a kind of icon. Whose interest was it to beat the drum for that picture?
Well, I think it came from a lot of things. You'd had the Depression and World War II, so people were sort of going, big sigh of relief, maybe I'll have a little more family time. Mm-hmm. That would be quite understandable.
Build our castle and celebrate life there, all that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the government was giving a very, very generous supports to nuclear families to set up in the suburbs mm-hmm. and, you know, establish this. And then on the other hand, you had this very, very repressive political atmosphere of McCarthyism and the Cold War and the bomb, so people retreated back to the oasis then. Then I think people began to move out of it in the 60s and 70s, but then we got slammed by a couple of other things. Mm. The tremendous speed up of work in the global economy, mm-hmm. so that today American workers, we've just recently surpassed Japan for the honor of working more weeks and days out of the year than any other industrial country.
Right.
You know, a dubious way of saying we're number one. We've also, with the high cost of housing, tended to, and of course no zoning, we have these bedroom communities now that are empty during the day. So as your caller said, you don't have neighbors or family to socialize with.
So the coffee clutch is hard to put together when all the gals or whoever's at home are working. And what, when we finally get home from work, we don't have time to go out and exercise a broader social network?
That's right. We go out and exercise by ourselves at the gym, but we don't go out. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember when people would go, when my parents would go out to socialize, either separately or together, they'd bring all the kids along. And it's not like they were really intense, involved parents. They'd send us up in a separate room to play or even spend the night.
So they'd be in the dining room or living room, and the kids would be off somewhere else, and that was fine. That not happening now?
It's not happening so much. We've become so privatized in our family life, in our sense that, the kids, you have to be quality time spending with your kids. And again, we're losing that time for socializing off the job. And, you know, time spent socializing off the job has declined dramatically since the mid-60s. And I do think a lot of that is because of the speed up of work and the number of hours people are spending at work. Plus, of course, when you multiply, when you double the fact that individual workers are spending more time on the job, but in dual earner families, that means you've got a doubling of that. The average dual earner family spends up to 82 hours a week on the job, and some spend more. So again, that really crowds out other possibilities for building and nurturing social ties beyond the home. And even at work, when the speed up, there's less time to, you know, talk around the coffee cooler.
It takes us back to the old bowling alone thesis of Robert Putnam some years ago now. But what about the impact of this? We'll hear from a marriage counselor in a few minutes here, but you've observed it, I'm sure, too. The impact inside the marriage, on the marriage itself, of this tighter and tighter dependence on the spouse, and then outside the message, what's the impact of the marriage? What's the impact for the broader society?
Well, for one thing, many people are living longer outside marriage in their 20s and 30s. The average age of marriage, first marriage for women, is 26, and if she's educated, it's 30 or more. The same thing is true for men. So the fact is that if all you're doing during that time is, you know, thinking, oh my gosh, I've got to get married to have a soulmate, that makes that potentially wonderful period of life a little more anxiety producing. Mm-hmm. Once you marry, then when it's good, it's very, very good. It's like the girl with the curl, you know.
Yep,
when she's good, she's very, very good.
When
it's bad, it's horrid, because there aren't those support systems to keep you going. When the marriage starts to falter, you don't know where to turn. And as Lynn points out, when the marriage breaks up, or if the marriage breaks up, you're completely isolated. And the worst offenders in isolating you are your formerly married friends. I've seen that over and over again when I do focus groups around the country. So it's bad in many, many ways. Now, I do not want to badmouth the fact that marriage today is fairer, more friendly, more fulfilling when it works than ever before in history. Somehow we want to keep a hold of that, I think. But we also have to start nurturing our social ties behind the home. And that means we have to break down the amount of social distrust that has built in America in the last 30 years of social inequality and political strife. And we also have to tell our employers and our government that we need to develop more, not just family-friendly, but life-friendly social policies and work policies.
And watch out for even that good marriage becoming so isolating that it's just carrying too big a load. Stephanie, if you stand by for a moment there in Tacoma, I want to turn to San Francisco. We're joined by Joshua Coleman, clinical psychologist with a family practice, senior fellow at the Council on Contemporary Families, author of The Marriage Makeover and The Lazy Husband. Josh Coleman, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you talk with a lot of married couples. Here's the study. It comes out and says they're depending too much on one another. Do you see it? Do you see it happening?
I do see it, and it's something that really concerns me. People are expecting to get a huge amount of their social and emotional needs met from their partners, and it's really burdening marriage. You know, if you look at surveys that were done as recently as 30 or 40 years ago, people had much more realistic expectations about what they were entitled to get from marriage. If you ask people getting married today, they really expect marriage to be the central wellspring of their happiness. And so what happens is that when that begins to falter, so for example, when couples become new parents, there's a drop in marital satisfaction for some 50 to 70% of couples. And many people panic at that point. They think, oh my God, I'm not with my soulmate. I need to get out. And many divorces occur at that time. And it's in part because we're living at a time when people's expectations about what they're entitled to get and they're supposed to get from marriage are really completely out of kilter.
So what? How do you gauge it? I mean, if someone looks at a spouse and says, okay, there's my lover, there's my, you know, practical life partner, there's my confidant, there's my best friend.
Right.
Can a spouse deliver all that? If they try, what's the price that gets paid?
Well, the price that gets paid is in, you're saying if the person doesn't deliver that?
Well, if they try to deliver it, is that a bad thing or a good thing? I mean, even if it works, is there some price here? And if it doesn't work, or if it burdens the marriage too much, how does that show up?
I see. Well, it's a good thing if both couples are up to the task and both have sufficient financial and emotional resources to meet it. In general, I think having high expectations is a good thing to start out with. But those expectations always have to be balanced against what your partner is actually really able to deliver, both on the basis of who they are psychologically and what they're able to provide in terms of their energy and their availability, time, and you know, emotionally. So real healthy marriages actually require a lot of maturity. You know, they really require that people look at who they're married to, what they're actually bringing to the table themselves in terms of their expectations, and trying to balance out all those forces.
And maybe keeping a social life alive outside that, we hope, magic circle. Let's take some callers here. Andy's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Fall in love with your show recently. I wanted to say I had the honor recently to date a woman who was very good about keeping up a lot of friends outside of her outside of the relationship that we had.
And how did that feel? What did you see there?
Well, she just put a lot of energy into it. And actually, at the time, I didn't actually understand why. I didn't respect it a lot. But anyway, the relationship didn't end up working out in the end. But after it was ending up, I was a little bit sick, and she brought over some dinner sometime, and I was kind of, you know, she was checking in on me.
Yeah.
And she recommended that, she said, well, instead of focusing on just, you know, one romantic relationship, why don't you start focusing on a lot of small relationships? And at some point, for some reason at that point, you know, I'd been sick and I hadn't told anybody. I didn't have any friends I was close enough to
right.
even know that I was sick.
Mm-hmm.
And that just clicked for me. And since then, I've been, you know, just reaching out to all the people that I've seen as valuable people around my life that I kind of wanted to know better and considered as friends, but really making time for them, and it's just introduced a whole new level of richness in my life.
Andy, that's a great story. Your phone line's breaking up a little bit, but let us pick that up. Stephanie Kuntz, and here it is kind of in a nutshell. Andy boils it down for us and says, you know, he had a girlfriend who had a lot of friends. He didn't. She's taught him to reach out more. It sounds to me as though he may be better positioned for a great relationship, even with one going forward, with that wider number of tent stakes out there.
Oh, I think so. I think, you know, and one of the interesting things is that it is true that women nowadays tend to be better at maintaining social relationships before, during, and then being able to draw on them if there's an after marriage than men do. And a lot of people say, well, that's just because men don't have these kind of emotional needs. That's not true at all. In fact, just 200 years ago, men were very much involved. They were the ones who did matchmaking and remembered big occasions and organized social ties. But in the 19th century, we got this rigid division of labor where men just took over all the work and women just took over all the emotions. It diminished both of them. So somehow we have to come back to a place where men and women have access to meaningful work, but they both make time to develop these social ties.
Josh, yes, please.
Yeah, I'm glad that you raised that, Stephanie, because it's something I see a lot in my practice, is that there's this stereotype about men not really being emotional, and men really actually are, have very deep-seated emotions. They're just not as comfortable talking about it, not as good talking about it. And typically for men, their wives are their best friends. And so what often happens, what I'm seeing in couples, is that because their wives are spending much more time with their children and much more worried about their children and much more feeling deprived on the outside, they're much less available to their husbands than they once were. And that's causing men to feel much more distressed because they don't have the same kind of rich social networks that women often have.
Why and how did that change, Josh Coleman? I mean, if you look back at the, let's just say, the popular television images from a few decades ago, it was all about the guys longing to get out to the bowling alley or the bar or the baseball league. And, you know, that's where their great buddies were. And the wife, yes, she was very important, but it was certainly not their only friend. What's happened to men's friendships?
Well, men are spending all their time working. Men are exhausted, and often what happens when men become new parents is that they, one of the ways that they feel like they can be best serve the family is to go out to work. So men are spending a lot of their time in employment.
So work is right there. Cammie's calling from Epworth, Iowa. Hi, Cammie. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think that before I got married, I think there was an expectation with marriage that I was supposed to participate in all my activities, all my things with my husband. And I've found out kind of through a coworker of mine that it doesn't work best that way sometimes, to drag my husband out to garage sales, things like that, that he doesn't enjoy doing. I can get the same kind of happiness that garage sales bring to me through a coworker of mine. We go garage sailing, and I think that people have this idea that when you're married, you have to do everything together. And I think it makes our marriage better when I don't have to drag him out to do the things that I necessarily like to do that he doesn't enjoy.
And is he happy to see you go? Is he happier when you get to exercise that and then come home and off you go to whatever he's interested in, or the two of you?
Yes, I think that it brings a certain happiness because we're both doing something we enjoy. We enjoy doing things together as well. We have two girls, and, you know, we enjoy being family. But there's certain parts, too, that, you know, I think it was just like the expectation. And once I kind of gave up that expectation and just accepted the marriage for what it was, that that things got a lot better. You know, with expectations, you think that it has to be, you do everything together. And,
right.
And just spending quality time is good enough. But if I enjoy other activities, he likes riding bikes and stuff like that. I don't particularly care for it. But I think deep down we have the core sense of a likeness. We both have the things that really matter, like
yeah,
the family.
So broaden the circle, and at the heart, it's working well. Cammie, thanks for that. Stephanie Kuntz, you know this number, that Americans now have only 2.08 people that they can share their serious thoughts with. That's kind of shocking, isn't it? I mean, if one of them is the spouse, that means on average people have only one person outside, and many no one outside of marriage, or no one at all, as Lynn Smith Lovin was saying. I mean, that seems like a very lonely state indeed.
Well, I find that true. Now, you have to remember that people don't particularly want to live this way, and some people use internet chat rooms and other kinds of activities to get beyond this. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to, you know, go into panic mode about this, but I certainly do want to go into warning mode about it. It is not good to just rely on one person to meet every other need. And, you know, even when that is seems to be happening, I'm not necessarily sure it's a great thing. You know, I seldom describe myself as old-fashioned, but there's one way in which I feel very old-fashioned. Mm. If you go back to the American Revolution, our founding fathers thought that bachelors who didn't take care of anyone were poor citizens, but husbands who focused just on their families were only one step above, that you had to have some social commitments beyond the family and social values, too. And I think that's important for
Stephanie,
a good marriage.
Hold the thought. And Josh Coleman will be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Faces are glowing with your love.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're asking this hour whether we ask too much of marriage these days, with the spouse increasingly seen as our sole true friend and confidant. We've been joined from San Francisco by Joshua Coleman, clinical psychologist there with a family practice, talks with a lot of married couples about how it's going, and from Tacoma, Washington by Stephanie Kuntz at Evergreen State College, author of Marriage, A History. Right now from North Augusta, South Carolina, Gail's on the line. Hi, Gail, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for the call.
Sure.
I wanted to say that after all this fun that you all see me like such doom and gloom, I feel very, very lucky. I've been married to my husband for 21 years. He's
yep.
an entertainer. He has his own life. We have a friend who's my friend, and she's our best friend. And we're all approaching retirement age now. And she has her health problems, no parents, two children who don't live here. And we're getting ready to move, and you know, she's moving with us, and my husband is.
Oh, that's great.
He automatically included her in the whole thing from the very beginning, you know, because he didn't want her to be left out. And I just found that takes a lot of the strain off of him, because she and I have a great relationship, and he doesn't mind being silly with both of us.
So you've got a built-in core there, which is more than two right away.
Yeah. And she's also very good because she doesn't take sides.
That's great. So you've got an open window on this. You're hitting the national average. If you've got your husband as a good friend and one more, at least you've got that. And it sounds like you're pretty serious about keeping it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Where I go, she goes. And where he goes, we go.
I love it. Retiring as a threesome. We wish you very good luck in that friendship, Gail. And we thank you for that call. Let me get one more from Fresno, California. Hi, Shirley. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell you, we're having our 43rd wedding anniversary this week.
Congratulations.
And we started off backwards. We started off trying to be everything to each other with competing interests, competing jobs, always whose competition or whose interests were going to be dealt with first. And then about 25 years ago, we went into marriage counseling because we were sort of in trouble. And we discovered that our hang-up was trying to be husband and wife. And we talked about it for a couple of years, and we decided what we really wanted to be was loving partners, supporting each other's interests for the rest of our lives. And I can't tell you how well that's worked. We each have jobs that are totally separate and different, and we both travel, and we have separate and different friends and friends in common. And I think the decision to try to get out of the traditional roles of husband and wife and be loving partners was just the key to how good we feel after 43 years.
So you don't see it as having diminished your marriage, your relationship, but in some way, by loosening it up, it enhanced it.
Oh, my goodness. It opened it up and made it wonderful. We think the whole world is out there because we're interested in such different things that we bring to each other. It has opened up our worlds and our marriage. We're almost too happy sometimes.
Almost too happy in Fresno. Shirley, thanks very much for that. Stephanie, what do you hear there? I mean, nobody is opposed to great marriages and great relationships, but then Shirley says, you know, ours became even greater by making it a little bit looser, certainly open socially.
Well, I think that's certainly been the pattern through the last 100 years, that as we got better marriages, it paradoxically became easier to improve your marriage by having other people. You know, another myth people have is that, oh, people were truer to each other. They had higher expectations of fidelity in the past. Not so. At the end of the 19th century, there was an epidemic of venereal disease among respectable married women because their husbands went to prostitutes so often because their communication was so bad. Now, I would argue that the one reason we've been able to move past this is that as people have trusted each other and really become deeper friends, they've also been able to let the other people have not affairs, but real friendships, real relationships. You know, in the 19th century, when honeymoons first started, people commonly brought neighbors or friends along for the visit. And I'll share a personal story myself.
On
that
the honeymoon,
really,
okay. Yep.
When my husband finally talked me into getting married, I was had studied marriage enough to be a little reluctant about
I bet.
It. I had already set up a trip to Italy with a friend. And I said, well, I can't back out of that with her, but I bet you she wouldn't mind if you joined us for half of it. And wow. My husband was secure enough mm-hmm. to say, that would be fun. And we had a wonderful time. You know, we thought we've got plenty of alone time in our lives. Why not share this big Italian trip together? And that worked out great for us. So well, I absolutely second what she's saying. But it does depend on trust and mutuality and equality, which marriages of the past, many of them did not have.
But in yours, bigger than two from the get-go, Josh Coleman, I still wonder what's driving this. I know we're working more hours, but you could also have friendships at work. I mean, is the economy somehow become so dog-eat-dog that do you think, is throwing married couples onto one another as the only one they're not competing with economically?
Well, there's that, and what happens is that people are so stressed out, even if you have a traditional marriage where dad's the primary breadwinner and mom's a stay-at-home mom, dad's having to work much harder than he did 30 years ago to maintain a standard of living. And mom is having to raise their children in a culture where parents are expected, mothers in particular, are expected to be so doting and available and psychologically tuned in and sophisticated
to the kids
and everything else mm-hmm. that mothers are under this enormous pressure to be perfect mothers. So what happens at the end of a day is that mom and dad reconnect, and both are feeling so deprived and so exhausted and so emotionally starved for somebody to take care of them that they in some ways go at each other because they both feel so entitled to be taken care of and yet have so little to give. And that's the problem that I see over and over again in the couples that I work with.
But you wonder if, I mean, we live in a time of gated communities, but under these pressures, if we're sort of clutching around almost gated relationships here. Let me take a call from Manchester, New Hampshire. Larry's on the air. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you today?
We're good. What do you see, Larry?
I'm the classic example of having an isolated marriage, but I'd say it's by choice.
Okay.
We were married for 26 years now. We have two kids, 21 and 25. And very early in the game when we had children, we were taking a look at just around in society. And with the loss of the neighborhood who's supporting your children, supporting your families, and the diversification of people and travel and global economies and everything, that we made a conscious decision that we were going to focus on our family and make sure that our children were brought up the way that we thought they should be brought up and be able to contribute to society when they got older.
So make the world go away, or at least we can't count on it, so we'll make our own little kingdom right here. And you're happy you did it, but do you feel you lost something along the way or not?
Well, in many ways, we did, maybe early in the game, felt that, you know, with the loss of friends we had, because I was 28 before I got married, mm-hmm. my wife was 25.
Mm-hmm.
But just recently, after 20 years, I saw somebody in my wedding party, and it's like we hadn't skipped a beat. But we hadn't seen each other in 20 years as a result of that.
Yeah, but there you are with the wagon circled, and it's worked out well. Yeah, Stephanie Kuntz, as you describe it, you know, that may work for a particular family, for Larry's, but at some level it may also speed the isolation or contribute to it of the neighborhood he wishes was there.
Well, I think so. I mean, I am totally opposed to these TV gurus who give one-size-fits-all solutions
mm-hmm,
to
sure.
people. You know, obviously, it depends on the individual. And if it works for your family, you know, that's fine. I am concerned about it as a larger social issue, as you say, because there is a sense in which we bring our kids up to think that they can only get their needs met by us as parents, and we can only get our needs met from each other as spouses and as co-parents. That seems to me to diminish social life in important ways. It prevents us from reaching out and finding other people to connect up with. I know my neighborhood was not a big populated neighborhood, but because of what I had learned historically, I really felt a need to send my child out, to go out myself. Well, we often spent our Christmases not at home, but helping out at shelters and other places like that. And in the process, we made good friends with other people who were doing that. And, you know, I think it's just so important to understand that societies require social trust. And can I say one thing, just looking back at what Josh said? said, I'm so glad he raised that. A lot of people think the solution to this problem is to go back to the 1950s male breadwinner model, where the man devotes all of his work to, you know, to earning the money, comes home, and the woman takes care of all those social ties. She does volunteering and stuff. Even when she did do volunteering and get outside of the home, it led to exactly the sort of polarization of human emotions that so that you can only be half a human. You lost the wholeness that Josh was talking about.
Yeah, we got the message. You don't want to go backward here to those kind of roles, and yet can we somehow give a father like Larry or a marriage like that one confidence that it can live in the world, not just in the twosome, and still be supported? Let me get another call here from Terry in Los Angeles, California. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, this is a great show because it's something that's been bugging me for about 2 months. And, you know, I just wonder where the boundary really is because my wife and I own a business together.
Okay.
And I do a lot of work. And she seems to have a lot more friends than I do. And she's, you know, always on the phone, always going with them places. But there's this one guy that's, it really bugs me because he calls her all the time. He's married, he has a kid, but he calls her, he does stuff for her.
Yeah.
It just seems to be going over the boundary, and I can't, she assures me there's no, he's just a friend.
Yeah, here we go.
Too much, you know, and
okay, no, I hear it. The boundary question comes in when the wife has tons of friends, including a male caller who seems to be too much in the air. Josh Coleman, what about boundaries when you and Stephanie are kind of encouraging wider relations? Terry needs to know.
Well, that's a very good and important question, and it's something that each couple has to navigate and negotiate. I think that people have to be sensitive to what their partners want in terms of if they feel threatened, particularly by an opposite gender friendship. At the same time, people have the right to have opposite gender friendships. So we can't be so sensitive to our partner's needs that we completely curtail our own desires to have friendships. So I would be, as a couples therapist, want to make sure that the trust in the marriage is on solid ground, that his wife is doing enough to reassure him that her love and priorities is with him, and also to see if his insecurities have any basis that either precedes the marriage or is indicative of any other stress that's within the marriage.
But is it enough for his wife to say, Terry, it's fine, don't worry about it, it's just a good friendship, chill out?
Well, not necessarily, because he may be worried because there may be a problem in the marriage that this speaks to. It may be, I don't know a thing about Terry, but I would be thinking, well, is Terry not able to communicate with her in a way that makes her want to talk with him? People sometimes have opposite sex friends because they can get emotional needs met that they can't get in the marriage, which some people call emotional affairs, but a friendship isn't necessarily an emotional affair. But that kind of thing can indicate that there may be a need in the marriage that isn't being met that could be better met.
Terry, maybe you can befriend the guy as well. You can keep an eye on it that way too, my friend. Walt's calling from Boston. Hi, Walt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's funny. This is sort of a wake-up call for me. I guess I'm your stereotypical male in the marriage that's concentrated on work, and I guess the problem that I have is trying to deal with family. I work so much, when I come home, I really feel that family should be the center of my time.
Sure.
You know, it's the kids, it's spending time. But I think when I look at my wife, she's involved in so many social aspects of the community that, you know, I look at it and I say, well, I probably should be doing that, but I'm kind of, I guess, selfish in the sense that I want to spend time with my family. I want that quality aspect, and I want her to feel that way.
But you feel like you might be missing something at the same time on the outside.
Right. So then trying to get her involved and the children involved and things that I like to do things as a family, is it has this dynamic tension that you're always trying to, I guess, have the ideal marriage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know anybody who wouldn't understand exactly what you're saying there. Stephanie, our time grows short. What's your advice to married couples who want to have that strong core relationship? I mean, Americans are pretty much in the thrall of the romantic love idea, and why not? But yet, you don't want it to be healthy and open enough that they're not leaning so hard on one another that the marriage and family and even, as you say, community suffers. How do you go for the golden mean here?
Well, if I knew that, I could be Dr. Phil on TV.
Well,
But I do. It's a challenge, and I think that if you embrace the challenge, you're more likely to solve the challenge. That you say to yourself, look, it is not easy to both nurture this strong couple relationship and to nurture these strong social relationships outside the home. But that's our goal. Let's take it as a joint project and work on it together, because I think when you embrace the contradictions or the problems, you actually get further than by trying to make one or the other side go away.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Wow, what a fascinating hour. We'll have to do it again sometime, but we're really grateful to both of you for being with us. Stephanie Kuntz in Tacoma, author of Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Stephanie, Professor Kuntz, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
It was really my pleasure.
And Joshua Coleman, author of The Marriage Makeover, Finding Happiness in Imperfect Harmony, joining us from San Francisco. Josh Coleman, thanks very much for being here today.
Thanks for having me as well.
A lot of fun. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by one big family. Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Philip Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rowley, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Dan Anclees, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.